I'd like to start the session this afternoon with, or the second session, with a song. And again, I think Al and I will be sort of complementing each other in moving from the social agenda to the cosmic agenda, to the social agenda to the cosmic agenda, trying to weave back and forth in between those. And this morning, Al was, laid out for us so clearly the kind of the devastation in the social order that we created. And the question keeps coming back to all of us, well, what do we do? Where can we move? And one of my contentions is that we just need to find all kinds of ways in every medium to move our consciousness from being embedded in the social order to a much greater sensitivity, a greater awareness of the cosmic agenda. So this, I have a couple of songs, and just over these few days, just to lay them out as a possibility. And the first one I'd like to share with you this morning is called "Touch the Earth," and it's a very simple chorus and then some verses. And I've been in groups where we've done it with movement. So maybe if we get to that stage, we can kind of choreograph the song at some point. But maybe just for once, to just listen and sing along. I'll play the chorus, I'll rewind it and replay the chorus, and then whenever you join in, whenever you can pick it up. It's no great big deal, but just an alternative perhaps that can help.
Sherman wrote the song.
And the tape is called Touch the Earth. There's a number of them. This, I think, is the best one on it. But maybe if you want to hang on, or just leave the sheets, and we can go over two or three of the songs in the next couple of days together, too. Or keep them and just have them on hand. What I thought might, take us another step this morning, Al, laid out or helped us look at this social reality that we have created. And by social, we mean the human construction, what humans have done to shape a system, economic, political, social, ecclesial, whatever. That's the understanding of the word social. And, if for many of us in our church communities, we have this last, 20, 25 years, we have really had a hard time moving or expanding our religious consciousness from a very personal religious journey to the social, to a sense that what we have created is really our responsibility. Humans have made decisions that have resulted in the systems that Al played out for us this morning. And so that is not the social reality, the ordering in society is not removed from who we are as a Christian, a person, a religious person. And we work very hard to change laws, to set up structures that ensure the kind of values and the goals that we want. What, for instance, even just, I don't know how long in your churches, but it is relatively new in the Christian church that we gather in a circle. Huh? I mean, we have this structurally, historically, we have been with one leader in front and all of us in rows because all the wisdom came from that place. That's what the structure said. We came in, sat, and somebody here spoke, and that was the source of the wisdom. I think today we understand much more clearly the Spirit speaking in the hearts of all of us, and together we form church. We are people who have a belief system that we try to enflesh in the world around us, and to do that, we have to find ways that allow the wisdom to emerge from the community. So we sit in a circle, and then everyone has a chance today. Right now, we do that differently. But the circle allows for that, and that structurally changes. And we then that very physical structure helps us internalize that something, some other phenomenon, some other truth is being enunciated for us. And that's it is that kind of structural change that has engaged us as a social body in more recent years. But my contention is now that social agenda has to be embedded in what we're being called to cosmically, what the earth, what the very dynamic of the creation is calling us to. And I know we cannot abandon, we do not, the social agenda is not complete in any way. We cannot abandon it. But to my mind, it is not viable into the future unless it is grounded in what we all come out of. Our groundedness in the very journeying, the very unfolding process of the earth itself, the universe itself. So this morning, I would like to just look again. I keep going back to what are both some of the history that we've come out of that have shaped us. Also, what are resources within that tradition that we have understood in a certain way, in a certain historical period, and now we're being asked to review them and look at them anew in the light of new understandings. And so I want to just take a couple of them this morning. We listed it as the commons, but he made reference this morning to the book of Robert Bella, Habits of the Heart. and many of you probably know the book. And Bella's book, it's a couple of years old now, but he just kind of went through the community because he reflected on the fact that as a people, as a society, we have lost a sense of being a communal body. We have the ideology of the individual has so encompassed us that the communal bonds have broken down, and our neighborhoods no longer serve for a communal base. You know, more often they're places we retreat to in isolation and fear. What ways do we better understand that? I have an architect friend, and he was saying to me one day, he said, you know, Jane, just thinking along these lines, I think back when I was designing houses 25 years ago, he said, we used to build homes with a front porch. And in that very building of the home, there was an assumption that you would spend time on the front porch and there were people who would pass on the street, and it was conducive to neighborliness. He said, today, everything is in the backyard. You have your private deck, your private pool, you're fenced in. It, the very building, the way the streets are laid, the very way we are constructing our homes is enunciating a value, that it is the individual and the personal and the private that's important. The communal dimensions have broken down. The other thing he said, you know, I laugh at it too. He said, you know, as a kid growing up, there were five of us in our house, and we had one bathroom. And he said, today, you know, you wouldn't think of building a home without two and a half bathrooms, and you can hardly sell a home on the market if you have only one bathroom. He said, but as kids, we learned to negotiate. You had to negotiate your turn. Hey, get out, I got to get in there. And that was part of life, and you learned skills that way. Today, you know, nobody has to, you can just go and do your own thing. So all kinds of indications of this kind of breakdown in the communal dimension, and Robert Bella's book was just a kind of a lightning rod to spark that into our attention. So we have struggled, I think, even as a Christian tradition, as a religious tradition, always between the individual good and the communal good. What we each have to take on ourselves as in the journey, but what is also a part of the communal outreach, the communal statement that we make. And some of the language we've used, there are values that kind of permeate our social teachings that reinforce what is a belief system on it. And for instance, one of them that would be foundational to what we would what would be our statements about how we are to be Christian in the world today, one of those would be the dignity of the human person. That's a bottom line for us. No matter what your color, your shape, your physical condition, where you were born, what no other circumstances negate the fact of your own dignity by being born human. And out of that belief system, we have established much of the kind of directions and programs that would forward the dignity of the human person. So, in fact, today, when in our society, in our own times, when we talk the language of the dignity of the human person, very quickly we move into the language of rights. Because you have your own dignity, you have certain rights. And those rights have to be guarded and protected. And the first major document that came out of the United Nations, the first achievement of that post-World War gathering of the human community, was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, 3 years after the founding of the United Nations. And that was an immense achievement on the human journey. Never before in the something like, 40,000 years of the human, the humans as we would know them, emerging and struggling to be human and organizing life and all, never before had the human community enunciated that there are certain rights that all of us have. And no matter, you know, how those are perhaps not honored, or how, what, no matter what the breakdown, the bottom line is there, that those rights exist, and we agreed to that, and nations have signed on. And so today, when there are outcries against violations of human rights, we have something that is a platform that says, yes, indeed. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has two covenants. One is the political civil covenant. It says that people have a right to gather like this. Huh? We have a right to do this, and nobody could challenge that. In our society, we would not tolerate that. A right to gather, the right to vote, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, that civic organization, all of those rights, we feel those very strongly. There is a second covenant that is also part and parcel, two parallel covenants in the Universal Declaration, the socioeconomic covenant, that says equally strongly that people have a right to food, have a right to housing, a right to education, medical care, those fundamentals of human life that allow the development of the human person. In our society, we are far from recognizing and institutionalizing that second covenant of socioeconomic rights. I often think today, you know, we're very, very concerned if a child doesn't go to school, and we have truant officers and telephone systems, and we can find out where that child is to get them into school. But whether that child comes hungry, we have no system really in place. We have the largesse of the community. You know, some churches and some schools and some places provide a breakfast maybe, but that's only at the largesse. That is not a foundational right that child has. We have a long way to go in our own society, as well as any country in the world. There's nobody, no country that can stand up and say, we've got this made. So, but because we as a people, as a human community, have enunciated that Universal Declaration, we have arrived at a goal that the human strives to achieve, that those rights be guaranteed. In fact, we say a society is just when human dignity is respected, human rights are assured, and human development is promoted. That's a grid of evaluation of a society. So those statements come as kind of landmark events in the journey. But I want to say today that even though that's true for us, and that we have a long way to go before we can say we have come anywhere near achieving the status where the Universal Declarations are recognized and honored and institutionalized, today we can no longer just be about the dignity of the human person. We, of course, that has to constantly inform us, but if we are repeating that language and are not saying to ourselves and to one another, and yes, also the dignity of all of creation, that's the breakthrough that we have to internalize. That it is not just enough to say we species have a uniqueness, but each species has its own unique role to play in the community. And this, the communal call is breaking in on this isolated individual human agenda. And if you say to me today, what do we teach our children? I think there can be no more compelling message than to teach our children who is the community to which they belong. I was in an Anglican church in Detroit earlier this year, during the service, there was a baptism, and it was a beautiful church, and in the round, and so all through the baptismal service, they had a great big pitcher of water, and so they, while the words were being read, they were pouring this water, and there was the beauty and the sound of that, and then this tiny child, you know, and wrapped up all and very small, and the baptism was performed. And then the pastor took the baby in his hands, and he went around to the whole community, and he just said, "Now, this is your child. This child belongs to you." And then he would say, "And child, you belong to the community." And he kind of moved through the church this way. And it was beautiful, and people were you know, all... And yet, as he was doing this, he walked right past two gorgeous plants that they had in the church. You go right past that to the choir. The choir was here, and then he moved around. And I'm saying to myself, unless that child also learns that this community, the soil, the plant, the air, the water, unless that child learns that that's its community also, there is no way that child has a future, and no way that you can say into our life, into our world, that if we're providing the maturity that a Christian child needs, that we all need. That community of life surrounds us, and we get born into it. And part of our task in life is to become more and more friends, more and more able to touch the earth. And if there is any kind of a breakthrough in sort of the Christian call today, it seems to me it is no longer just to be turning in on our own agenda, but to open ourselves out to what is being. And so can we, you know, if we use the language, the dignity, the uniqueness of the human, of course, but it is incomplete today. It is dysfunctional almost. If that is our sole focus, and we are not constantly saying to ourselves and to one another, but the dignity of the whole, the dignity of all, each species, and to find ways to make that real for one another. I was one day up at that retreat center where my husband and I spent the year. I was out walking one day, going down to the lake, and I just started down this path, and all of a sudden, this little bird was right there in front of me, and she started to kind of flap her wings and go off like this, and move, and I'm looking, you know, and I follow the bird a little ways, and then she took off, went up into the trees. And I continued my walk on down to the lake, down this way, and I'm thinking to myself, what's that all about? So when I got back at noon, we were sitting around the table, and I said, you know, the funniest little thing this morning, this little bird. They said, "Jane, that was a killdeer. The bird, the female lays her eggs on the ground. They're very mottled. You don't notice them. If you get too close to those, the mother does this act as if she has a broken wing to take you away from those eggs, so that you will not destroy that life." And I'm saying to myself, you know, college graduate and all this hotshot stuff, and that little bird led me down the path that would assure life for her young. And I say, this is a miracle. This is a miracle. That all of those ways in the earth, in the different species, the kind of interchange, interdependence, and the creativity and the ingenuity that's there, that for most of us, we are blind to it. We haven't engaged, we aren't entranced by the beauty of our earth, by the call that is to us as a people. And so therefore, of course we can cut down the trees and we can destroy species and make them extinct and all, because we have not shared, we have not entered that community. And so today I am saying it is not enough to teach our children, to teach ourselves about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that important document that stands as a landmark on the journey. Well, that document, we need to learn it. But also today, from the United Nations, we have a second document, the World Charter for Nature. The World Charter for Nature has come through that same process within the United Nations. And you can say to me, you know, what's the UN? What is the UN? What is it? But the one institution that we as a human community, as a human species, have been able to establish to bring together the concerns of the world community. It is the one form. And over the years I was the liaison between our center in Washington and the United Nations, and I did a lot of work within that forum. And you know, all the criticisms of it are most of them are right on target. It is a bureaucracy, it has all the faults and warts and problems of any human institution. But if we do not have it, we will create another, or we will improve it, because it is an essential institution in the evolution of the human community today, that we have a forum where we can come together. I used to stand at the door and watch people from all different countries and shapes, and many of them in their dress, you know, that they wear in their own countries, and looking different, and their geographies and their culture and their religious history and background coming together and trying to sit around and talk about population or food or the aging, the problem of aging, or the problem of the water or the spread of the deserts, or youth or women or young baby, the whole, everything that engages us as a human community gets talked out in different ways within that forum. But I what I would notice is that walking in that front door, no matter what their dress, everyone had their own little attaché case. That was the one kind of universal symbol that we all carry, our papers, our security is there. But I used to think to myself, it is either that or a gun. You know, either we will find mechanisms to understand better, to share, to establish structures that are life-giving, or we will kill one another. So when the UN produces something, it is the accumulated wisdom of the community. That's as much as you can say about it. It is the best that we are able to say as a community that we can agree upon at this moment in history. So that Universal Declaration came out of the wisdom of the community. Today, the World Charter for Nature comes out of the wisdom of the community, that we can say something like this: every form of life is unique, warranting respect regardless of its worth to the human, and to accord other organisms such recognition, the human must be guided by a moral code of action. In a declaration, in a statement out of the United Nations. And it goes on to say, nature shall be respected and its essential processes shall not be impaired. Every species has a right the population levels of all forms of life must be at least sufficient for their survival. It goes on and on, and we can say it's just words. It's not being done. But it is the foundational statement. We can call one another to this. We can go to our governments and say, you signed on this. Why are you destroying those wetlands? We agreed to this. And we have a foundation to do that. So our awareness of where the sense of dignity is expanded today calls us into that larger Earth community. But it is a value that has been central within our faith tradition. Huh? So we are not taking ourselves out of our stream. We are not being unfaithful. We are not being distracted. We are being called by our time to speak the truth of our time out of our own tradition. And when we talk of the dignity of all, then that is what we have to enlarge and awaken in ourselves. So whether or not, you know, whether or not we help our young people learn who they are in that enlarged community of life becomes our religious task. It is not something divorced or outside of. Whether or not we kind of encourage our communities, what do we do about Christmas trees? Christmas is coming, you know. Is there a new way to think about how to be responsible vis-a-vis our traditional celebrations around the Christmas tree? You know, we've gone out and cut them and cut down the tree and made that our symbol of this celebration. more and more people are saying, why not bring the living tree into our community? And that tree can be replanted again. And it can share in the celebration of that time, but it is not a sharing that comes out of death. Now, I know even as I'm saying that whole industry is in place to grow Christmas trees, to cut them so that you and I can have them in our home. So it falls back on a whole systemic question. But if individual choices begin to shape some other belief, that impacts the system. Ralph Nader says today it takes only a 5% change in consumer decision-making to have an impact on what industry produces. If we begin to make decisions out of a truth that we see, that gets carried out in all the arenas of our lives. And that begins to shape how the system itself actually operates. That's just one small example. And there are many others that you have yourselves, I'm sure. But it is because it is not just, you know, a good environmental practice, but it is also because we are expanding our consciousness of our own religious tradition. That all of that has dignity in the very fact of its creation. And it is not there for the use of the human, exclusively. That's an important word, exclusively. Because in the rhythm of the planet, in the rhythm of the earth, of course, there is a constant giving of life for life. There is a constant paschal mystery, death and life emerging. Death and life. But death given for life, and life taken for life. So that we eat the green plants. We eat living creatures. But not out of a sense that we have every right to that, and they have no other meaning except to be food for us. But it is in this exchange of life and death in the community. And then the community lives. So that moves us into another whole arena. Our sense of awareness of the individual gets expanded, and our sense of the community. And that's the other arm of this exploration, at least this morning for a little bit, that we have said the dignity of the human person, that has grounded us in our social teachings. We've also said the common good. The good of the common is also part and parcel of it is not an exclusive. We are not a lone ranger religion, you know, where individuals can go off and do their thing exclusive of the community. No. We have said deeply embedded in our social understanding is our concern for the common good. The common. But historically, how we have translated that is the common good of the human community. How do we provide for one another? In our economic system, our political system, our social system, our cultural, our religious, those systems that are in place to provide for the community. As a tradition, we deeply believe in the role of government. We are not an ahistorical, apolitical people, even though in many ways we've acted out of that. But our vision of a religious tradition would say that we organize ourselves in a way to provide for those who can least provide for themselves. That's what government is all about. That's why we have a body politic, to provide for those who can least provide for themselves. And that's the grid that we put over any government. Whether you vote Republican or Democrat or whatever is a second question. The first question is, who best provides for the common good? Who can best provide for those who can least provide for themselves out of whatever circumstances? So this kind of communal call comes out of our tradition. But we have looked at that almost exclusively in terms of what does that mean for other people? How do we provide for people? And my contention is today that if we are living out of that kind of core value that pervades our tradition, well, what we must ask ourselves is, who are and what are our commons today? It is not enough to say our commons are all these 5.5 billion people that inhabit the earth, but our commons include the wetlands and the forests and the ozone layer and the Arctic caps and the rivers and the wildlife and the sea and all that make this community possible. And they too become part of our concern for the common good, the good of the commons. That's what the word ecology, you know, that very word, it comes from the Greek word, the first part of it, echo, ecio, is from the Greek word oikos, which means the household. The household. And the science of ecology is an effort to look at what are the relationships that make that a viable household. If you can go to school, you know, you can go to university and get a degree in ecology. At the University of Wisconsin, they've had for many years in Madison, they've had a very fine ecological program. And the university is right on two lakes, and they say they are the two most studied lakes in the whole world because all the graduate students take those ponds as their household and try to say, well, what has to happen in those ponds? What kind of plant, animal life, what makes that a viable reality, that household? And that's what the study of ecology is, but there is also a social ecology. That introduced probably John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, the one who helped us say, he's standing in front of those giant redwood trees in California and saying, it is sacrilege on the part of our species to destroy these magnificent creatures, 300, 400, 500, 600 years old. They're for their own rightful place in the community and not there to be cut down and made toothpicks by one species. And that kind of social awareness that there is a relationship in the community, that's the ecological movement, you know, that we are related to one another. And the way the native people say it is a web of life. You pull one strand and you touch the whole. You pull one thread in your sweater and it has ramifications to the whole garment. It is the same, that there is a totality, a wholeness, a web that we are all related to. So that's one level of our commons today, that we enlarge our agenda for the common good to look at that, to include that. But secondly, what we know today in ways that we did not know in the past is that we have come out of a common history. There is a 15 billion year journey that the universe has been on. And that journey is of a piece. It is the journey of the universe, the emergence of the earth, the emergence of life, the emergence of consciousness, and the human. It is of a piece. And we, most of us, don't know who we are. We don't know our story. We don't know that is who and how we have come evolved. I'm in the middle of a fascinating book right now, Gaia, The Human Journey from Chaos to Cosmos. And it is just a piece of this breaking through in our consciousness of how much all of that was critical to shaping the reality that we are today. And that the human, the kind of assumptions that we move around in, probably something like 40,000 years is the time span, you know, of species that you and I would recognize as other humans. 40,000 years in a time span that has gone back 15 billion years. And even our Earth alone, something like 5 billion years old, 4.5 to 5 billion. So we are very new, we are very young as species. And our great hope is that we can kind of understand our story better so that we can learn how to live in light of the story. And what you know, some of the messages that come out of that for us, the irreversibility of that story. It has been one journey, the story has been creative from the beginning, not determined how it would result, nor random that anything would happen, but creative. Each moment, the earth creating its reality by who we are, by all the way the life of the earth is unfolding. It is creative. And so we don't know, but we are our greatest gift is to be the creative component in that unfolding story, to offer our gift of genius, to be the ones who can better understand how that journey has unfolded, and to say yes to it, and to create and bringing forth another level of its life of the planet. But all of that is not just scientific information for us. That we know better the story today. We can go back, we have instruments that can take us back to that very, to something of the very first bursting forth of that end. You call it the Big Bang, the kind of the burst of, no bang, there was no noise, all the best, we can say flaring forth of energy. But in that flaring forth contained all that has unfolded. And in some way, I say the Christian God I grew up with is too small. If the God that in a fraction of whatever gave forth this journey and all that has emerged, the galaxies, the billions of stars, and we know today another 100 billion galaxies, just boundless, endless creativity. And we look around the earth and no one thing, anything else. Each its own creative entity, its own sacred interiority, its own rightful place. And in the journey that some dinosaurs, we no longer have them, they're gone. But at a certain moment they had their role in the journey. And whatever that event was, it was for greater life to emerge. That has been that life will perdure. That is the journey, that is the message we take out of our looking at the journey of the universe. Whether species along the way get destroyed, we have that evidence. If they do not contribute to the whatever that core life of the journey is. So in knowing our story, we have immense wisdom to garner. Because the earth has had its journey, has had its message, its sacredness from the beginning. So we have we understand our commons differently. We have a common history that we have to learn. Tom Berry says today there are only three great learnings that must engage the human. We must learn the journey of the universe because it is our own story. We don't know who we are unless we know it. We must learn who we are in this community of life. And thirdly, the kind of unfolding, and maybe it's not as firm, but that what seems to be being revealed to us today is that our earth, we do not live on the earth. The earth itself lives. And it lives through the interchange and the feedback mechanisms and the whole community of exchange that's going on. They call it the Gaia theory, that the earth itself lives. How can those immense learnings are not for some isolated human being over here, but it is for each one of us in our totality, in our deepest religious roots, in our deepest scientific roots, in our deepest human roots, whoever we are, that's the earth, that's the world we are a part of. And it is that then that becomes kind of such a focus for us in our ongoing, why are people asking all around, today what's going on? Why this new language we're talking, creation spirituality, creation-centered spirituality. We haven't had that kind of historically. At least we haven't named it. We haven't had kind of a stream of theological study that's looking at that more formally. Something is happening. There is a breakthrough in human consciousness. That we are a different kind, we are a species among others, and learn our way. And I think one of the signs to us coming out of our social reality, Al mentioned it this morning, suicide among young people. 15 to 24 years of age, it is the first cause of death. Young people destroying themselves because we have not helped them, we have not given them a vision, an allurement into the future, a place that will draw them and situate their lives in a larger community. We are in our old story, locked here. And it's the cry of the earth, it's this challenge to us, it's drawing us beyond where we were. And of course it is gray, and of course it is uncertain, and we're all saying how. But I think we will not discover the how unless we are deeply convinced that it is the journey. Unless we are convinced that that is what the human is about in our times. We will do little Mickey Mouse things, perhaps, but the radical how to be in that position has to engage us in ways that we can hardly dream of now. They have a history and they have a reality. It is again and again I come back to that, this community of life that we are part and parcel of. And I am suspicious of the word stewardship even. I know in our churches, in fact, who was telling me the other day? Oh, someone in Spokane was saying to me, a teacher at Whitworth College in Spokane who was on sabbatical, and he's a biology teacher, and he said, I wanted to look at my biological and my spiritual life. I wanted to bring those together. But he said he was doing a research paper, and he looked up in some document under the word stewardship, and he said there were 75 different kinds of ways talking about how to be stewards of our money in our churches. That's what stewardship had meant. And when we use the word very easily now in terms of being stewards of the earth, I think we can easily carry over some of that attitude. And my contention is we don't know how to be stewards of the earth. We are learners today in from the earth itself. And if our posture is that we have the answer already, I don't think we will be giving the kind of radical response. We have to learn from the earth. I say go put our butt out under that tree and sit and let the earth give us its message. And that is, I know that sounds, I mean it figuratively. In that how we do our gardening, how we grow our crops, how we establish our economic system lives in a bubble. Al demonstrated this morning, it has no grounding in the earth. No grounding in the reality of the earth. We can take those resources and do with them, never saying that the bookkeeper is the earth. The greatest bookkeeper is the earth. And we are being called now to turn in our chips. And we are seeing that we have had this attitude of just taking and never being responsible. But we don't have that attitude out of nowhere. It has a deeply religious rooting for us. And that's my contention. We've got to go back to those roots and water them anew in the light of our times.